your affectionate niece, Helen Stoner. Now, dear Aunt Honoria, my deepest thanks for your invitation to spend a little time with you in Harrow after Julia's wedding. Indeed, I feel a short break will be almost necessitated by the excitement of seeing my sister married. Even our stepfather, Dr. Roylott, seems well disposed towards the event. Julia herself has not long left me to go to bed, and even now, I suppose, will be lying awake next door thinking of her happiness to come, while I... My God, Julia! Julia! Julia. Julia, your face. What is it? What is it?
Helen!
Oh my God!
The Speckled Band by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Dramatized for radio by Vincent McInerney. With Clive Merrison as Sherlock Holmes and Michael Williams as Dr. John Watson. And featuring Susan Wooldridge as Helen Stoner. The Speckled Band.
Watson.
Mm-hmm.
Watson, old man.
Good heavens, Holmes. A quarter past seven? What on earth is going on?
A client, Watson. A client in a considerable state of excitement.
But who? Why so early?
Who? A young lady. As to why, well, presumably when people wander about the metropolis at this hour, they have something pressing to communicate, and should it prove an interesting case...
My dear fellow, I would not miss it for anything. Then you've seen her?
Oh, yes. Even said good morning to her. Mrs. Hudson gave her some coffee in the sitting room. I glanced in as I passed. 30 or so, I fancy. Dressed all in black, hair shot with grey, but pitifully agitated, with restless, frightened eyes, like some hunted animal.
Mm-hmm. Or so. It's not just coffee she needs, then, but kindness.
Ah, madam. I am Sherlock Holmes, and this, my intimate friend and associate, Dr. John Watson, before whom you can speak as freely as before myself.
Mr. Holmes, Dr. Watson.
Madam. But you must be cold, I think, travelling at this hour. Come into the main part of the room, I beg you, and draw up to the fire.
It is not cold which makes me shiver, Mr. Holmes.
Indeed, what then?
It is fear, Mr. Holmes. It is terror.
You must not fear, Miss...
Stoner. Helen Stoner?
No, for I have no doubt we shall soon set matters right. You have come in by train this morning, I see, although, of course, you had a journey before that.
You know me, then?
Simply, I observe the second half of a return ticket in the palm of your left glove, while the seven spatters of mud on your left-hand jacket sleeve bespeak time spent along a heavy road sitting next to the driver in a dog cart.
I see Mrs. Farintosh was right in what she said regarding your abilities.
Mrs. Farintosh, I'm not sure I remember.
Before your time, my dear Watson, merely an opal tiara and death by bishoping. Miss Stoner, please sit down.
Oh, thank you.
There. So, you have come far?
The western borders of Surrey to Leatherhead, and then by first train to Waterloo. Mr. Holmes, I can stand the strain no longer. Nor have I anyone to turn to... Save one, Percy. That is a Mr. Armitage, who cares for me very much, but can be of little aid as regards my domestic circumstances, who indeed seems to think what I am suffering from are the fancies of a nervous woman. But they are not fancies, Mr. Holmes. They are dangers, real dangers. And I must have some help to walk amongst them.
Then, Miss Stoner, you must begin by laying everything in front of us that may help us form an opinion on the matter.
My name, then, as I have said, is Helen Stoner. And I live on the borders of Surrey with my stepfather, who is the last survivor of one of the oldest Saxon families in England. The Roylotts of Stoke Moran.
Roylotts, the name seems familiar. Watson.
Indeed. A long and distinguished history. Although somewhat checkered, I believe, towards the end of the...
Regency. Oh, you are right, Doctor. Four dissolute heirs, followed by a gambler, reduced one of the richest families in England to ruin. Lands that once stretched into Berkshire and Hampshire were reduced to a few brambled acres, and the house itself crushed under a heavy mortgage. The last squire dragging out a life of aristocratic poverty. His son, however, my stepfather, saw he must adapt to new conditions, took a medical degree and went out to Calcutta, where by skill, toil and force of character he established a large practice, until a series of robberies occurred on his property in which he thought his native butler was involved.
And?
He beat the man to death.
For which he stood trial?
Only narrowly escaping a capital sentence. It was offered in his defence that he did not know his own strength. And he is physically quite terrifying. As it was, he received a long term of imprisonment, returning to England at the end of it a morose and disappointed man.
But, Miss Turner, what about... How did...
Dr. Roylott become my stepfather? Mm. In his early days, he met and married my mother, the young widow of Major General Stoner of the Bengal Artillery. My twin sister, Julia, and I were 2 years old when the marriage took place. Julia?
More coffee, Miss Stoner. Here, let me. Watson, you know, is an old India hand.
Afghanistan, actually.
Afghanistan. Here you are, Miss Stoner. And when you're a little more composed, but in your own time.
Yes. Thank you. Well, first I think you should know my mother had £1,000 a year at the time of her remarriage, which she settled on our stepfather, but with a provision that should my sister or I marry, we should receive a certain sum from the settlement.
Your mother is dead?
We returned to England 10 years ago. 2 years later, she was involved in a fatal rail accident near Crewe. After her death, Dr. Roylott, who had been attempting to establish himself in practice in London, suggested that we pack up and move back to Stoke Moran. There was enough money for our wants and seemingly no obstacle to our happiness.
I assume he reverted.
Yes. Yes, he did. Our neighbours, who had initially welcomed the return of a Roylott to Stoke Moran, well, sufficient to say two incidents finished in the police courts, while in another he threw the local blacksmith over a parapet into a stream, an indulgence that cost all the money I could gather to prevent further public exposure and disgrace. He has become the terror of the village, and I speak the truth when I tell you the only living things which will have anything to do with him are a cheetah and a baboon he has imported from the east, and a band of wandering gypsies who have his permission to camp on what is left of the estate.
A drear existence.
Drear, solitary, and hard. For, of course, no servant will stay, except a decrepit housekeeper, Mrs. Mims, who hardly knows the days of the week any longer.
So who now runs the house, Miss Stoner?
I do, Doctor. All tasks inside and out. Although until 2 years ago I had Julia to help me. Poor Julia, she was but 30 at her death, and yet her hair had already begun to whiten, even as mine has.
So she too is dead?
Mr. Holmes, it is the events surrounding Julia's death which bring me here today. You understand that, given the circumstances of our life, we saw little of anyone of our own age. We did, however, have an aunt near Harrow we were sometimes allowed to visit at public holidays. There, 2 Christmases ago, Julia met a half-pay major of Marines to whom she became engaged.
Mm, and your stepfather's reaction?
Quite equable. He invited the groom over to the house, spoke with generosity in terms of the forthcoming ceremony, and then, within a fortnight of what was to be the happiest day of my sister's life, the terrible tragedy occurred which deprived me of my only companion.
Miss Stoner, pray be precise as to details.
It is easy for me to be so, Mr. Holmes, for every event of that terrible time is seared into my memory. First, however, you must have some idea of the manner of our life at Stoke Moran. It is, as I have intimated, now ruinous and almost completely closed down. The living accommodation being reduced to the ground floor of one of its two wings, a long corridor off which three bedrooms open, each with a window looking out onto the lawn. First, Dr. Roylott's, then that which was Julia's, with myself at the far end. On that fatal evening, then, 2 years ago, Dr. Roylott had gone to his room early, though not to retire to rest, but rather to smoke. Indeed, it was the pungent smell from his Indian cigars that had initially driven Julia into my room, where we chatted for a time about her approaching wedding.
But, Helen, you must wear a veil as my chief bridesmaid.
In this house, Julia, it is rather as if I've taken one.
Helen, if you are not careful, he will hear you.
Julia, I am not really bothered.
Oh, Helen, had I your insouciance?
The night had been stormy, and about 11 became appreciably worse, at which point Julia felt it was time to retire. So she rose to leave me and had reached my door.
Helen, have you ever heard anyone whistling in the dead of night?
Why, no, Julia, never.
I suppose it could not be you in your sleep.
Julia, dear, I cannot even whistle whilst I am awake. It would hardly have been on Mama's list of attributes every young lady should possess.
I am silly. But you know I am a light sleeper. And, well, these last few nights, about 2 in the morning, I have been disturbed by a low, clear whistle. Though once I am awake, I have no idea where it has come from.
The gypsies in the plantation, perhaps. I believe they have a way of communicating with whistles.
Then why have you not heard it? Your window opens onto the lawn as mine does.
But you are the restless one, my dear.
Of course. Well, it is probably of little consequence. Good night, dear. God bless.
And with that, Julia smiled at me, closed my door, and a few minutes later I heard the key turn in her lock.
This was a regular thing, Miss Stoner, to lock yourself in at night.
The cheetah and the baboon.
Indeed, quite so. Proceed, if you will, Miss Stoner.
I confess that I had treated the affair much more lightly than I had actually felt. As I've already mentioned, we were not only sisters, but twins. The links that bound our souls, both subtle and penetrating. So I knew Julia was ill at ease, frightened, even terrified. I determined I would not sleep. The night wore on, the rain lashing against the windows, the wind howling, when suddenly I sprang from my bed and rushed into the corridor.
Julia!
My sister's door was slowly swinging open. I stared, horror-stricken, not knowing what was going to issue from it.
Julia.
Then slowly, Julia appeared. Her face blanched, her hands groping before her for help, her whole figure swaying like that of a drunkard. She writhed as one who is in terrible pain, and her limbs were dreadfully convulsed. At first I thought she had not recognized me, but as I bent over her, she suddenly shrieked out in a voice I shall never forget.
Helen! Oh, my God, Helen! It was the band! The speckled band!
Then stabbed with her finger towards our stepfather's door, then convulsed yet again, and then...
And then, Miss Stella?
And then Dr. Roylott appeared in his dressing gown, poured brandy down her throat and sent for aid to the village. But to no avail, for she never recovered consciousness.
And that is all you saw and heard?
No, Mr. Holmes. There was something I thought I heard when first I opened my door. First a low whistle, such as my sister had described, and a few moments later a clang of metal.
You are sure about this? You could swear to it.
I did so to the coroner. And yet, amid the crash of the gale and the creaking of the old house...
And the coroner's verdict, Miss Stoner?
No satisfactory cause of death, no marks of violence. He investigated with great care, not least because of our stepfather's reputation, but my evidence showed all the windows on the ground floor were stopped with wooden shutters, the doors locked on the inside, the chimneys barred across, the floors solid. No, she was alone when whatever it was happened.
And poison?
The doctors examined her without success.
The gypsies were not considered?
Indeed, Mr. Holmes, they were my first thought. I have spoken of their whistling to each other, and then there was Julia's mention of the speckled band. You know how so many of them always wear bandanas with stripes and colours and such around their heads.
Yes, yes, perhaps. These are deep waters. However, your stepfather was in his dressing gown. How then was your sister attired?
In her nightdress. Oh, one other thing. Hmm? In one of her hands was the charred stump of a match. In the other, a matchbox.
Showing she had time to strike a light and look about when the alarm came. How interesting and important. Tell me, Miss Stella, immediately after these terrible events, did your stepfather's attitude change? Did he, that is, become more violent, more conciliatory, more thrusting, more retiring?
I could not say. After the funeral, my doctor advised a short holiday, so I went to the Armitages near Reading, a connection of my aunt's. That is where Percy and I... You heard me mention Mr. Armitage earlier.
Of course, yes.
Well, after that visit 2 years ago, Percy and I began a correspondence. A correspondence that in the course of time has... Well, we are to be married in the spring.
Oh, congratulations, Miss Stella.
Thank you. I told Dr. Roylott, who showed nothing but benevolence and said it would provide an excuse to have some repairs done to the fabric of the house, starting with my room, how the mortar between the stone was crumbling and how some of those same stones must be removed, which, of course, means...
You have moved into your sister's room.
Quite, Doctor. And now sleep in the very bed she did. Where, last night, I was awakened by a low whistle.
You lit the lamp?
Immediately, but saw nothing. Too shaken to go to bed again, however, I dressed and waited for daybreak, ran to the Crown Inn for a dog cart, and quickly made my way here.
Which means we also must move quickly to see over the ruins of Stoke Moran, preferably when your stepfather is absent. Miss Stoner, is this possible?
As it happens, he too has business in town this morning, and as he seldom returns before nightfall, then today of all days might be your best chance.
Today it will be, after lunch to be exact, for there's much to do first. Almost 8 o'clock. Miss Stoner, should we arrive shortly after one, would you have returned by then?
I think so. There are some things to arrange regarding my wedding, but I fully intend to be home by lunchtime. If Dr. Roylott should return early, perhaps we had better meet outside of the house?
Yes, you have a suggestion?
There is only one path from the station that leads to Stoke Moran, so if you took the local dog cart and I waited in one of the fields alongside that path...
Ah, excellent, excellent. Here, let me hand you your gloves.
Oh, thank you.
Miss Stoner, there's marks on your wrist.
Oh, no, really, Dr. Watson, they are nothing.
Impossible to fob off an old medical dog like that, I'm afraid. May I?
Oh.
Bruises. Your stepfather must indeed be physically overwhelming.
I mentioned he is said not to know his own strength.
You have been cruelly used.
Yes, the generic term, I believe, for those who are said not to know their own strength is bully. Watson, perhaps you could show our guest out. Miss Stoner, we will see you at Stoke Moran sometime early this afternoon.
And with that, Holmes took up his pipe and sat abruptly down in the chair in front of the fire. And putting his chin in his hands, he began staring intently into the crackling flames. I saw Miss Stoner into the street, and then return to our sitting room.
Well, Watson, a dark and sinister business.
Indeed. Dark enough and sinister enough. And the gypsies?
Well, even taking into account the strange words uttered by Julia, headband, whistles and such, I'm not sure that Holmes might not just be...
What in the name of the devil?
Out of my way, madam! Out of my way! Which of you is Holmes?
This rage-strangulated inquiry, delivered in a voice like a mad bull's, came from a man of huge and terrifying demeanour, whose bulk almost completely filled the doorway. His clothes, too, were as bizarre in their appearance as he was, being an uneasy mixture of plough and pulpit, in that they ranged from a black top hat and long frock coat to a pair of farmer's gaiters and a hunting crop. But there was little Christianity in the face which glowered above the neck stock, for it was a visage seared with a thousand wrinkles, burned yellow with the eastern sun, marked with every evil passion, and containing a pair of deep bile-shot eyes set on either side of a thin, fleshless nose. Overall, in fact, our visitor looked very much like a thoroughly out-of-sorts aging bird of prey, and all the more dangerous because of it.
I said, which of you is Holmes?
My name, sir. Please come in, if you will, Mrs. Hudson. That will be all. Thank you.
Oh, yes. I'll come in.
I'm afraid you have the advantage of me.
I, sir, am Dr. Grimesby Roylott of Stoke Moran.
Indeed, Doctor. Pray take a seat. Watson, perhaps our guest would like a cushion. Mm.
Cushion? I want nothing of the kind. My stepdaughter has been here. I followed her. She suffers from delusions. Now, what's she been saying to you?
It's a little cold for the time of year, I think.
She said that?
The crocuses seem to promise well. In the wrong hands, Dr. Royle, that a hunting crop is a vicious and cowardly weapon, though certainly not as dangerous as the service revolver my associate here always carries about his person to deal with any mad dogs we may chance upon.
I see. I see. Well, I know you, you scoundrel. I've heard of you before. Holmes the meddler. Holmes the busybody. Holmes the Scotland Yard jack-in-office.
Ah, oh, most entertaining, Dr. Roylott. When you go out, I wonder if I might ask you to close the door. There's a decided draught.
I will go when I've had my say. I'm a dangerous man to fall foul of, Mr. Holmes, especially to those who meddle in my affairs. Here, let me show you. There. An example of my grip, Mr. Holmes. See you keep out of it!
Pass me the poker, Watson, as a good fellow. Yeah. Not quite as straight as it was, though Mrs. Hudson will hardly notice the difference. And now to business. You go to Waterloo, if you will, and take two tickets for the first train to Leatherhead after 1 o'clock, mine to be left at the booking office. Yep. I to a doctor's commons, and on the journey, we will compare notes. And if you could, old fellow, an empty compartment.
Shall I take anything?
Your revolver, an Ely's number 2, is an excellent argument with gentlemen who can twist steel pokers into knots. That and a toothbrush are all I think we'll need.
Five hours later, as requested, I chose an empty compartment on the Leatherhead train and watched anxiously from the door. But there was still no sign of him as the guard blew, and we began to move off. About to pull my head in, I suddenly saw Holmes vault over the barrier, deftly deposit his ticket in the top pocket of the astonished collector's waistcoat, and begin to sprint up the platform, from whence he swung himself aboard without a hair out of place, and settled into a corner seat. Then, oblivious to my presence, he drew some papers from his pocket and fell to scribbling and frowning, and scribbling again. For my part, sitting opposite him, I gazed out of the window for a time, and then, what with the steady rattling of the train over the rails, the green of the Surrey countryside, and the bright sun concentrated through the glass window.
What? No, Holmes. Of course. The sun, you understand, all that weight.
Yes, but look at this. A copy of the mother's will. Checking her investments, I find the income from them now to stand at about £750. And of this income, each daughter is liable for a third at marriage. Mm. It is evident, therefore, that even one of the girls marrying would cripple Roylott to a serious extent. But if both were to leave home with husbands...
Why, he would be reduced to a mere pittance.
Just through these trees and we're there. Oh, but I am frightened, Mr. Holmes, to learn that Dr. Roy had followed me to your lodgings. His temper
is... Miss Stoner, I assure you that I personally shall deliver you to your aunt at Harrow if needs be. But that will be decided, but... Ah.
And there before us lay the manor house of Stoke Moran. A building of grey, lichen-blotched stone, with a high central portion and two curving wings like claws of a crab thrown out on either side. One of these wings, that on our left hand, was in a complete state of disrepair, with its windows out and roof fallen in, while the center block was little better. But the right-hand wing was comparatively modern, with three windows looking out from it onto the lawn. The end of this block was surrounded by scaffolding.
That end window, I take it, Miss Stirner, belongs to your room, this one to your sister's, and the next one to Dr. Roylott's chamber.
Exactly so. But I am now sleeping in the middle one.
Pending the alterations, as I understand. Miss Stirner, I wonder if you would have the kindness to go into your sister's room, open the hasp of the window, then bar the shutters.
Oh, certainly.
Holmes, there hardly seems to be any pressing need for repairs to this end wall.
No, indeed. Nor any workmen around to effect them. That is suggestive.
An excuse, perhaps?
Yes, perhaps. Ah. Thank you, Miss Stoner. Now then. Yes. No possibility there. And no room even to get a knife blade in under the bar.
Yes.
Hinge is solid, let into the stone. My theory certainly presents some difficulties. What price gypsies now, eh, Watson? No one could pass through these shutters if they were barred. Thank you, Miss Stoner. We shall now join you inside.
It was a homely little room, with a low ceiling and gaping fireplace, after the fashion of old country houses. A brown chest of drawers stood in one corner, a narrow white counterpane bed in another, a dressing table on the left of the window, and two small wickerwork chairs. Holmes drew up one of the chairs and sat silent, while his eyes travelled round and round and up and down, taking in every detail.
That bell pull above the bed, where does it communicate to?
The housekeeper's room.
Yes, it looks newer than the other thing.
Yes, it was only put there a couple of years ago.
Your sister asked for it, I suppose.
Oh, no. I never heard of her using it. We always used to get what we wanted for ourselves.
Yes, just so, if you'll permit. How very interesting.
What, Holmes?
It's not even attached to a wire. It's merely fastened to a hook. Just above the ventilator.
How absurd. I never noticed that before.
Very strange. There are one or two very singular points about this room. For example, what a fool a builder must be to open a ventilator into another room when, with the same trouble, he might have communicated with the outside air.
That is also quite modern.
Yes, done about the same time as the bell rope.
Yes, there were one or two little changes carried out about that time.
They seem to have been of a most interesting character. Dummy bell ropes and ventilators which do not ventilate. With your permission, Miss Stoner, we shall now carry our researches into the inner apartment.
Dr. Roylott's room, though larger than that of his stepdaughter, was plainly furnished. A camp bed with an armchair beside it, a shelf full of books, a round wooden table with a single chair, and a large iron safe.
Miss Stoner, what's in here?
Why, I have only seen into it once, years ago. It was full of my stepfather's papers.
Then he would not say, keep a cat in it.
A cat?
There's this saucer of milk lying at its side.
Oh, I see. Well, there is the cheetah, Mr. Holmes, and the baboon.
With due respect, Miss Stoner, a cheetah is a very big cat, while this is a very small saucer. However, there is one further point I should wish to determine. This chair. That is quite settled. Hello? Here is something interesting. What do you make of that, Watson?
It's a common enough whipcord dog lash.
Quite tied in a loop, though.
I could not say.
Not quite so common, then. It's a wicked world. And when a clever man turns his brain to crime, it is the worst of all. Miss Stoner, it is essential that you now follow my advice in every respect.
I shall certainly do so.
Your life may depend upon your compliance.
I am in your hands.
Then in the first place, both my friend and I must spend the night in your room.
Oh, if it is necessary, of course. But, Dr. Roylott...
In a moment, Miss Stoner. Now, that is the village inn across the fields there.
Yes, that is the Crown.
Yes, and this window would be visible from there.
Certainly.
Then when your stepfather comes back, be confined to your room with a headache. Wait for him to retire for the night and open the shutters, undo the window hasp and show a lamp as a signal to us. Then withdraw to your old room and leave the rest in our hands.
I believe, Mr. Holmes, that you have already made up your mind.
Perhaps I have.
Then was it, as I have thought, a sudden fright?
I believe what killed your sister was much more tangible.
We took our leave of the frightened girl and walked across the fields to the Crown, where we engaged a room on the upper floor, commanding a view of the Avenue Gate and the inhabited wing of Stoke Moran Manor House. We ordered and ate an early dinner, and took our chairs to the open window and sat in companionable silence as dusk fell. Drove on, and a few minutes later we saw a light spring up among the trees as Roylott lit a lamp in the sitting room.
You know, Watson, I really have some scruples about taking you tonight. There is a distinct element of danger.
Can I be of any assistance?
No, your presence would be invaluable.
Then I shall certainly come.
Oh, thank you.
Look, the light in the sitting room's gone out.
No, it's not yet 9. He's merely closed the shutters. It'll be some time yet before he retires to his chamber. But for one thing, he will want to feel Miss Stoner is asleep.
You evidently saw more in those rooms than I did.
No. Simply deduced a little more. The bell rope, the ventilator.
It's so small. A rat could hardly pass through it.
I knew we'd find one even before we came to Stoke Moran.
My dear Holmes.
You recall how Miss Stoner said her sister was driven from her room by the smell of Roylott's cigar. Well, I realized then there must be a small ventilator.
But what harm can there be in it?
Well, there is at least a curious coincidence of dates. Did you observe anything peculiar about the bed?
No.
It was clamped to the floor.
Clamped?
Indeed. It could not be moved, and must therefore always be in the same position relative to the ventilator and the bell rope, as must any head resting upon the pillow.
My God. I seem to see dimly what you're hinting at. How horrible.
Horrible enough. When a doctor goes wrong, he is the first of criminals. And more horrors to come before the night is over. So, for the time being, let us have a quiet pipe and take in the beauty of the moon,
the trees, the night. And so we did, and 2 hours passed slowly away. Then suddenly, at the stroke of 11, a single bright light shone out right in front of us.
That is our signal.
We made our way quietly downstairs and out into the night, Holmes pausing only to take up a thin, whip-like cane from the stand near the inn door. There was little difficulty entering the grounds of the house, the wall having long fallen into disrepair, and we quickly made our way through the trees, across the lawn, and were just about to pull open the window of Julia Stoner's old room.
What the devil?
No, hold your fire, Watson. It's only the doctor's baboon. Indeed, a nice household.
And the cheetah?
No doubt up a tree, waiting to descend on our shoulders. Now, before we go in, you will take one of the chairs, keeping your revolver on your knee, and do not fall asleep if you value your life. I will sit on the side of the bed with a candle and matches and this. Shortly after we go in, I will put out the light to make him think Miss Stoner has gone to bed. And then, well, then we will see. Right, old fellow, in we go.
How shall I ever forget that dreadful vigil? broken only by the cry of the occasional nightbird outside, and once a long drawn-out snuffling whine from the window, which told us the cheetah had found us and had come to investigate. But for the rest, no light, no sound, no movement. Nothing but the sense of my companion sitting open-eyed within a few feet of me, and in the same state of nervous tension as myself. Far away, we heard the deep boom of the parish clock as it tolled the quarters, and how long each one seemed. But gradually the hours slipped by. Midnight, one, two, three. Then suddenly a gleam of light appeared at the ventilator, to vanish immediately. A moment later came the strong smell of burning oil and heated metal. Someone in the next room had lit a dark lantern and drawn its shutter. For half an hour there was no other sound. And then my ears picked up something. Something very strange in being just audible, yet also somehow very soothing. Altogether like a small jet of steam escaping continually from a kettle.
You see it, Watson? You see it?
Where, Holmes? What is it?
Stay back, Watson. Stay back, man, if you value your life.
The devil, it's escaped me. It's got back.
Back, Holmes? Where? What has?
Good God, Holmes. What was that? What does it mean?
That it's over. And perhaps, after all, it's for the best. Take your pistol, and we shall enter Dr. Roylott's room.
And it was a singular sight that met our eyes. On the table in Roylott's chamber stood the dark lantern throwing a beam of light onto the safe, the door of which was ajar. Beside the table, on the wooden chair, sat Dr. Grimesby Roylott, clad in a long dressing gown, his bare feet thrust into red heelless Turkish slippers. Across his lap lay the short whip with the small loop tied in its end. But it was his face. His chin was cocked upwards, his eyes fixed on the ceiling in a dreadful rigid stare. Across his brow he had a peculiar yellow band with brownish speckles, which seemed to be bound tightly round his head.
The band. The speckled band.
For God's sake, Holmes. What is it?
Swamp adder. Most venomous snake in India. Death within 10 seconds. Indeed, does violence recoil on the violent and the schemer fall into the pit which he digs for another. And now, I'll try to distract it with a cane. You go for the noose, then into the safe. Right. Right. Right.
Well done, old man. Well done.
What a dreadful way to die.
Oh, indeed.
And that cry. What agony he must... Why, Miss Stoner?
My heart. Oh.
Yeah, no, Miss Stoner, I do not come in. There is nothing there you would want to see.
You are wrong, Mr. Holmes. I must see. I beg you to stand aside.
Miss Stoner.
What was it?
A snake, Miss Stoner. Another of the doctor's deadly pets, but one that turned on its master.
His face, just like Julius. So that's what he used. But why?
For the third of your mother's legacy that he would have lost by Julia's marriage as he would yours.
So monstrous a deed for so derisory a sum. Who would believe it?
Exactly. I wonder, Miss Stoner, if I might advance an idea with a view to canvassing your opinion. The doctor is dead through, it might be argued, his own carelessness. However, any hint that his death was not so simple would, I feel, lead to prolonged and searching inquiries, public inquiries, in which your name and that of your sister would figure largely. On the other hand, should Watson here go to the country police when it's light and inform them truly that the doctor has merely suffered from an accident, I have no doubt at all I could put you onto the train to your aunt tomorrow morning without you ever being bothered again regarding this matter. I stress that while this is not perhaps an ideal solution, it is possibly an acceptable one.
Mr. Holmes, may I, your arm... I would go closer if I might. Mr. Holmes, Dr. Watson, my view is that justice has been done. Now, please, help me back to my room.
A classic case, then, Doctor, of my reasoning from insufficient data and thereby coming to an entirely erroneous conclusion. The presence of the gypsies and the dead sister's use of the word band putting me entirely on the wrong scent. I can, however, claim the merit that I instantly reconsidered my position when it became clear that the danger could not have come from the window or the door, but must have been the work of an inside agency. Then, of course, came the discovery of the false bell pull. This hanging alongside the ventilator gave me the idea it was simply there as a bridge for something to pass through the ventilator and down to the bed. The notion of a snake came immediately, and as the doctor was furnished with a supply of creatures from India...
A wild coroner, of course.
Yeah, not a hope, Watson. A form of poison that could not be discovered by chemical test. Why, it would be a sharp-eyed coroner indeed who could distinguish the small punctures where the two fangs had done their work. Then there was the whistle. Of course, he must recall it before morning light and have trained it to return by use of the saucer of milk.
Kept near the safe, which in turn gave rise to the clang as the snake was locked in it during the day. But how would he know it would bite?
He did not. Not on any given occasion. He would simply slip the snake through the ventilator at the hour he thought best, with the certainty it would crawl down the rope and land on the bed. Then, sooner or later, even if it took a week...
Truly horrible.
Indeed. Indeed. I had more or less come to these conclusions before I entered the doctor's room, the safe and the loop of whipcord merely adding to my conviction. What finally convinced me beyond all reasonable doubt, however, was the chair.
The chair?
You recall how closely I examined it with my glass.
Ah, yes.
What it told Watson was that Dr. Roylott was in the habit of standing on it, usually an unnecessary pastime, unless one wants to put something through a hole above one's head.
By Jove.
And it was simply a matter of baiting our trap and waiting for the strike. When it came, in the shape of a hiss, I instantly lit the match and attacked the creature, arousing its snakish temper and driving it back through the ventilator where it flew at the first person it saw.
Indeed.
Which means, as you have gathered, that I am indirectly responsible for the death of Dr. Grimesby Roylott of Stoke Moran.
My dear fellow, you...
Although I cannot say it is likely to weigh very heavily on my conscience. Cigar?
In The Speckled Band... Sherlock Holmes was played by Clive Merrison and Dr. Watson by Michael Williams. Helen Stoner was played by Susan Wooldridge. With Jane Whittenshaw as Julia Stoner and Ian Lindsay as Dr. Grimesby Roylott. The violinist was Leonard Friedman. The Speckled Band was dramatized for radio by Vincent McInerney and directed by Patrick Rayner.